Bran. Long before the first pale fingers of light pried apart Bran's shutters, his eyes were open. There were guests in Winterfell, visitors come for the harvest feast. This morning they would be tilting at Quinton's in the yard. Once that prospect would have filled him with excitement. But that was before. Not now. The Walders would break their lances with the squires of Lord Manderley's escort, but Bran would have no part of it. He must play the prince in his father's solar.
Listen, and it may be that you will learn something of what lordship is all about,
Maester Lewin had said. Bran had never asked to be a prince. It was a knighthood he had always dreamed of, bright armour and streaming banners, lance and sword, and a warhorse between his legs. Why must he waste his days listening to old men speak of things he only half understood? Because you're broken, a voice inside reminded him. A lord on his cushioned chair might be crippled. The Walder said their grandfather was so feeble he had to be carried everywhere in a litter, but not a knight on his destrier. Besides, it was his duty.
You are your brother's heir, and the Stark in Winterfell,
Sir Roderick said, reminding him of how Rob used to sit with their lord father when his bannermen came to see him. Lord Wyman Manderley had arrived from White Harbour 2 days past, travelling by barge and litter, as he was too fat to sit a horse. With him had come a long tail of retainers, knights, squires, lesser lords and ladies, heralds, musicians, even a juggler, all aglitter with banners and surcoats in what seemed half a hundred colours. Bran had welcomed them to Winterfell from his father's high stone seat with the direwolves carved into the arms, and afterwards, Sir Roderick said, he'd done well. If that had been the end of it, he would not have minded, but it was only the beginning.
The feast makes a pleasant pretext, Sir Roderick explained, but a man does not cross 100 leagues for a sliver of duck and a sip of wine. Only those who have matters of import to set before us are like to make the journey.
Bran gazed up at the rough stone ceiling above his head. Rob would tell him not to play the boy, he knew. He could almost hear him, and their lord father as well.
Winter is coming, and you are almost a man-grown, Bran. You have a duty.
When Hodor came bustling in, smiling and humming tunelessly, he found the boy resigned to his fate. Together they got him washed and brushed. The white wool doublet today, Bran commanded, and the silver brooch. Sir Roderick will want me to look lordly. As much as he could, Bran preferred to dress himself, but there were some tasks, pulling on breeches, lacing his boots, that vexed him. They went quicker with Hodor's help. Once he had been taught to do something, he did it deftly. His hands were always gentle, though his strength was astonishing.
You could have been a knight too, I bet, Bran told him. If the guards hadn't taken your wits, you would have been a great knight.
Hodor?
Hodor blinked at him with guileless brown eyes, eyes innocent of understanding. Yes, said Bran. Hodor, he pointed. On the wall beside the door hung a basket, stoutly made of wicker and leather, with holes cut for Bran's legs. Hodor slid his arms through the straps and cinched the wide belt tight around his chest, then knelt beside the bed. Bran used the bars sunk in the wall to support himself as he swung the dead weight of his legs into the basket and through the holes.
Hodor!
Hodor said again, rising. The stable boy stood near 7 feet tall, all by himself. On his back, Bran's head almost brushed the ceiling. He ducked low as they passed through the door. One time, Hodor smelt bread baking and ran to the kitchens, and Bran got such a crack that Maester Lewin had to sew up his scalp. Mickon had given him a rusty old visorless helm from the armory, but Bran seldom troubled to wear it.
The Walders laughed whenever they saw it on his head. He rested his hands on Hodor's shoulders as they descended the winding stair. Outside, the sounds of sword and shield and horse already rang through the yard. It made a sweet music. "I'll just have a look," Bran thought. "A quick look, that's all." The White Harbor lordlings would emerge later in the morning with their knights and men-at-arms. Until then, the yard belonged to their squires, who ranged in age from 10 to 40. Bran wished he was one of them so badly that his stomach hurt with the wanting. 2 quintons had been erected in the courtyard, each a stout post supporting a spinning crossbeam, with a shield at one end and a padded butt at the other. The shields had been painted red and gold, though the Lannister lions were lumpy and misshapen, and already well scarred by the first boys to take a tilt at them. The sight of Bran in his basket drew stares from those who had not seen it before, but he had learned to ignore stares. At least he had a good view. On Hodor's back, he towered over everyone. The Walders were mounting up, he saw. They brought fine armor up from the twins, shining silver plate with enameled blue chasings. Big Walder's crest was shaped like a castle, while Little Walder favored streamers of blue and gray silk. Their shields and surcoats also set them apart from each other. Little Walder quartered the twin towers of Frey with the brindled boar of his grandmother's house and the ploughman of his mother's, Craighall and Darry respectively. Big Walder's quarterings were the tree and ravens of House Blackwood and the twining snakes of the pages. They must be hungry for honor, Bran thought, as he watched them take up their lances. A Stark needs only the dire wolf. Their dappled grey coursers were swift, strong, and beautifully trained. Side by side they charged the Quintons. Both hit the shields cleanly and were well past before the padded butts came spitting around. Little Warder struck the harder blow, but Bran thought Big Warder sat his horse better. He would have given both his useless legs for a chance to ride against either. Little Walder cast his splintered lance aside, spied Bran, and reined up. "Now there's an ugly horse," he said of Hodor. "Hodor's no horse," Bran said.
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Big Walder trotted up to join his cousin.
"Well, he's not as smart as a horse, that's for certain."
A few of the White Harbor lads poked each other and laughed.
"Hodor."
Beaming genially, Hodor looked from one Frey to the other, oblivious to their taunting.
"Hodor! Hodor!"
Little Walder's mount wickered.
"See, they're talking to each other. Maybe Hodor means I love you in horse."
"You shut up, Frey." Bran could feel his color rising. Little Walder spurred his horse closer, giving Hodor a bump that pushed him backward.
"What will you do if I don't?"
"He'll set his wolf on you, cousin," warned Big Walder.
"Let him. I've always wanted a wolfskin cloak."
"Summer would tear your fat head off," Bran said. Little Walder banged a mail fist against his breastplate.
"Does your wolf have steel teeth to bite through plate and mail?"
"Enough!" Maester Luan's voice cracked through the clangor of the yard as loud as a thunderclap. How much he had overheard, Bran could not say, but it was enough to anger him clearly.
"These threats are unseemly, and I'll hear no more of them. Is this how you behave at the twins, Walder Frey?"
"If I want to." Atop his courser, Little Walder gave Luan a sullen glare as if to say, "You're only a maester. Who are you to reproach a Frey of the crossing?"
"Well, it is not how Lady Stark's wards ought to behave at Winterfell. What's at the root of this?"
The maester looked at each boy in turn.
"One of you will tell me, I swear, or..." "We were having a jape with Hodor," confessed Big Walder. "I'm sorry if we offended Prince Bran.
We only meant to be amusing. He at least had the grace to look abashed. Little Walder only looked peevish.
And me, he said, I was only being amusing too.
The bald spot atop the mace's head had turned red, Bran could see. If anything, Lewin was more angry than before.
A good lord comforts and protects the weak and helpless, he told the phrase. I will not have you making Hodor the butt of cruel jests. Do you hear me? He's a good-hearted lad, dutiful and obedient, which is more than I can say for either of you.
The maester wagged a finger at Little Walder.
And you will stay out of the godswood and away from those wolves, or answer for it.
Sleeves flapping, he turned on his heels, stalked off a few paces, and glanced back.
Bran, come. Lord Wyman awaits.
Hodor, go with the maester, Bran commanded.
Hodor,
said Hodor. His long strides caught up with the maester's furiously pumping legs on the steps of the great keep. Maester Lewin held the door open, and Bran hugged Hodor's neck and ducked as they went through.
The Walders, he began, I'll hear no more of that. It's done.
Maester Lewin looked worn out and frayed.
You were right to defend Hodor, but you should never have been there. Sir Roderick and Lord Wyman have broken their fast already while they waited for you. Must I come myself to fetch you, as if you were a little child?
No, Bran said, ashamed. I'm sorry. I only wanted...
I know what you wanted, Maester Lewin said more gently.
Would that it could be, Bran. Do you have any questions before we begin this audience?
Will we talk of the war? You will talk of naught.
The sharpness was back in Lewin's voice.
You are still a child of 8.
Almost 9.
8,
the maester repeated firmly. Speak nothing but courtesies unless Sir Roderick or Lord Wyman puts you a question. Bran nodded. I'll remember. I will say nothing to Sir Roderick of what passed between you and the Frey boys. Thank you. They put Bran in his father's oak chair, with the grey velvet cushions, behind a long plank and trestle table. Sir Roderick sat on his right hand, and Maester Lewin to his left, armed with quills and inkpots, and a sheath of blank parchment to write down all that transpired. Bran ran a hand across the rough wood of the table, and begged Lord Wyman's pardon for being late.
Why, no prince is ever late,
the Lord of White Harbour responded amiably.
Those who arrive before him have come early, that's all.
Wyman Manderley had a great booming laugh. It was small wonder he could not sit a saddle. He looked as if he outweighed most horses. As windy as he was vast, he began by asking Winterfell to confirm the new customs officers he had appointed for White Harbour. The old ones had been holding back silver for King's Landing rather than paying it over to the new King of the North.
King Rob needs his own coinage as well, he declared, and White Harbour is the very place to mint it.
He offered to take charge of the matter, as it pleased the king, and went from there to speak of how he had strengthened the port's defences, detailing the cost of every improvement. In addition to a mint, Lord Manderley also proposed to build Rob a war fleet.
We have had no strength at sea for hundreds of years since Brandon the Burner put the torch to his father's ships. Grant me the gold, and within the year I will float you sufficient galleys to take Dragonstone and King's Landing both.
Bran's interest picked up at talk of warships. No one asked him, but he thought Lord Wyman's notion a splendid one. In his mind's eye, he could see them already. He wondered if a cripple had ever commanded a warship. But Sir Roderick promised only to send the proposal on to Rob for his consideration, while Maester Lewin scratched at the parchment. Midday came and went. Maester Lewin sent Puxy Tim down to the kitchens, dined in the solar on cheese, capons, and brown oat bread. While tearing apart a bird with fat fingers, Lord Wyman made polite inquiry after Lady Hornwood, who was a cousin of his.
She was born a Mandalay, you know. Perhaps when her grief has run its course, she would like to be a Mandalay again, eh?
He took a bite from a wing and smiled broadly.
As it happens, I am a widower these past 8 years. Time I took a wife. Don't you realize? I mean, I'll get lonely.
Tossing the basai, he reached leg.
Or if the lady fancies a younger lad, well, my son, Wendell, is unwed as well. He is off south guarding Lady Catelyn, but no doubt he will wish to take a bride on his return. A valiant boy and jolly. Just a man to teach her to laugh again, eh?
He wiped a bit of grease off his chin with the sleeve of his tunic. Bran could hear the distant clash of arms through the window. He cared nothing about marriages.
Wish I was down in the yard.
His lordship waited until the table had been cleared before he raised the matter of a letter he had received from Lord Tywin Lannister, who held his elder son, Sir Willis, taken captive on the Green Fork.
He offers him back to me without ransom, provided I withdraw my levies from his grace and vow to fight no more.
You will refuse him, of course, said Sir Roderick.
Have no fear on that count, the Lord assured him. King Rob has no more loyal servant than Wyneman Mandalay. I would be loath to see my son languished at Harrenhal any longer than he must, however. This is an ill place. Cursed, they say. Not that I am the sort to swallow such tales, but still, there it is. Look at what's befallen this Janus Slint, raised up to Lord of Harrenhal by the Queen, and cast down by her brother. Shipped off to the Wall, they say. I pray some equitable exchange of captives can be arranged before too very long. I know Willis would not want to sit out the rest of the war. Gallant, that son of mine, and fierce as a mastiff.
Bran's shoulders were stiff from sitting in the same chair by the time the audience drew to a close, and that night, as he sat at supper, a horn sounded to herald the arrival of another guest. Lady Donella Hornwood brought no tale of knights and retainers, only herself, and six tired men-at-arms with a moose-head badge on their dusty orange livery. "We are very sorry for all you have suffered, my lady," Bran said when she came before him to speak her words of greetings. Lord Hornwood had been killed in the battle on the Green Fork, their only son cut down in the Whispering Wood. Winterfell will remember.
"That is good to know."
She was a pale husk of a woman, every line of her face etched with grief.
"I'm very weary, my lord. If I might have leave to rest, I should be thankful."
"To be sure," Sir Roderick said, "there is time enough for talk on the morrow."
When the morrow came, most of the morning was given over to talk of grains and greens and salting meat. Once the maesters in their citadel had proclaimed the first of autumn, wise men put away a portion of each harvest, though how large a portion was a matter that seemed to require much talk. Lady Hornwood was storing a fifth of her harvest. At Maester Lewin's suggestion, she vowed to increase that to a quarter.
"Bolton's bastard is massing men at the Dread Fort," she warned them. "I hope he means to take them south, to join his father at the Twins. But when I sent to ask his intent, he told me that no Bolton would be questioned by a woman, as if he were true-born and had a right to that name."
"Lord Bolton has never acknowledged the boy, so far as I know," Sir Roderick said. "I confess, I do not know him."
"Few do," she replied. "He lived with his mother until 2 years past, when young Domerick died and left Bolton without an heir. That was when he brought his bastard to the Dreadfort. The boy is a sly creature, by all accounts, and he has a servant who is almost as cruel as he is. Reek, they call the man. It's said he never bathes. They hunt together, the bastard and this Reek, and not for deer. I've heard tales, things I can scarce believe, even of a Bolton. And now that my lord husband and my sweet son have gone to the gods, the bastard looks at my lands hungrily.
Bran wanted to give the lady 100 men to defend her rights, but Sir Roderick only said,
"He may look, but should he do more, I promise there will be dire retribution. You will be safe enough, my lady, though perhaps in time, when your grief is past, you may find it prudent to wed again." "I am past my childbearing years. What beauty I had long fled," she replied, with a tired half-smile. "Yet men come sniffing after me, as they never did when I was a maid."
"You do not look favourably on these suitors?" asked Lewin.
"I shall wed again if his grace commands it," Lady Hornwood replied. "But Moore's Crowfood is a drunken brute, and older than my father. As for my noble cousin of Manderley, my lord's bed is not large enough to hold one of his majesty, and I am surely too small and frail to lie beneath him."
Bran knew that men slept on top of women when they shared a bed. Sleeping under Lord Manderley would be like sleeping under a fallen horse, he imagined. Sir Roderick gave the widow a sympathetic nod.
"You will have other suitors, my lady. We shall try and find you a prospect more to your taste. Perhaps you need not look very far, sir."
After she had taken her leave, Maester Lewin smiled.
"Sir Roderick, I do believe my lady fancies you."
Sir Roderick cleared his throat and looked uncomfortable. "She was very sad," said Bran. Sir Roderick nodded. "Sad and gentle, and not at all uncomely for a woman her years, for all her modesty, yet a danger to the peace of your brother's realm, nonetheless." "Her?" Bran said, astonished. Maester Lewin answered,
"With no direct heir, there are sure to be many claimants contending for the Hornwood lands. The Tallhearts, Flints, and Carstocks all have ties to House Hornwood through the female line, and the Glovers are fostering Lord Harry's bastard at Deepwood Mott. The Dreadfort has no claim that I know, but the lands adjoin, and Roose Bolton is not one to overlook such a chance."
Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers.
"In such cases, her liege lord must find her a suitable match."
"Why can't you marry her?" Bran asked. "You said she was comely, and Beth would have a mother."
The old knight put a hand on Bran's arm.
"Kindly thought, my prince, but I am only a knight, and besides too old. I might hold her lands for a few years, but as soon as I died, Lady Hornwood would find herself back in the same mire, and Beth's prospects might be perilous as well."
"Then let Lord Hornwood's bastard be the heir," Bran said, thinking of his half-brother John. Sir Roderick said,
"That would please the Glovers, and perhaps Lord Hornwood's shade as well, but I do not think Lady Hornwood would love us. The boy is not of her blood."
"Still," said Maester Lewin, "it must be considered. Lady Danella is past her fertile years, as she said herself. If not the bastard, who?"
"May I be excused?" Bran could hear the squires at their swordplay in the yard below, the ring of steel on steel.
"As you will, my prince," said Sir Roderick. "You did well."
Bran flushed with pleasure. Being a lord was not so tedious as he had feared, and since Lady Hornwood had been so much briefer than Lord Manderley, he'd even had a few hours of daylight left to visit with Summer. He liked to spend time with his wolf every day, when Sir Roderick and his maester allowed it.
No sooner had Hodor entered the godswood than Summer emerged from under an oak, almost as if he had known they were coming. Bran glimpsed a lean, black shape watching from the undergrowth as well.
"Shaggy," he called. "Here, Shaggy Dog, to me."
But Rickon's wolf vanished as swiftly as he had appeared. Hodor knew Bran's favourite place, so he took him to the edge of the pool beneath the great spread of the heart tree where Lord Eddard used to kneel to pray. Ripples were running across the surface of the water when they arrived, making the reflection of the weirwood shimmer and dance. There was no wind, though. For an instant, Bran was baffled. And then Usher exploded out of the pool with a great splash, so sudden that even Summer leapt back, snarling. Hodor jumped away, wailing, "Hodor! Hodor!" in dismay, until Bran patted his shoulder to soothe his fears.
"How can you swim in there?" he asked Usher. "Isn't it cold?" "As a babe, I suckled on icicles, boy. I like the cold."
Usher swam to the rocks and rose, dripping. She was naked, her skin bumpy with goose prickles. Summer crept close and sniffed at her.
"I wanted to touch the bottom."
"I never knew there was a bottom."
"Well, might be there isn't," she grinned. "What are you staring at, boy? Never seen a woman before?"
"I have so." Bran had bathed with his sisters hundreds of times, and he'd seen serving women in the hot pools, too. Usher looked different, though, hard and sharp instead of soft and curvy. Her legs were all sinew, her breasts flat as two empty purses.
"You've got a lot of scars." "Everyone hard-earned."
She picked up her brown shift, shook some leaves off it, and pulled it down over her head.
"Fighting giants?"
Usher claimed there were still giants beyond the wall. "One day, maybe I'll even see one."
"Fighting men."
She belted herself with a length of rope.
"Black crows oft as not. Killed me one too," she said, shaking out her hair.
It had grown since she'd come to Winterfell, well down past her ears. She looked softer than the woman who had once tried to rob and kill him in the Wolf's Wood.
"Heard some yattering in the kitchen today about you and them Freys."
"Who? What did they say?" She gave him a sour grin.
"That it's a fool boy who mucks a giant, and a mad world when a cripple has to defend him."
"Hodor never knew they were mocking him," Bran said. "Anyhow, he never fights." He remembered once when he was little, going to the market square with his mother and Septa Mordain. They brought Hodor to carry for them, but he had wandered away, and when they found him, some boys had him backed into an alley, poking him with sticks.
"Hodor!"
he kept shouting, cringing and covering himself, but he had never raised a hand against his tormentors. "Septon Shale says he has a gentle spirit."
"Aye," she said, "and hands strong enough to twist a man's head off his shoulders if he takes a mind to. All the same, he better watch his back around that Walder. Him and you both. The big one they call Little, it comes to me he's well named. Big outside, little inside, and mean down to the bones."
"He'd never dare hurt me. He's scared of Summer, no matter what he says."
"Then might be he's not so stupid as he seems."
Usher was always wary around the direwolves. The day she was taken, Summer and Grey Wind between them had torn three wildlings to bloody pieces.
"Or might be he is, and that tastes of trouble too."
She tied up her hair.
"You have more of them wolf dreams."
"No." He did not like to talk about the dreams.
"A prince should lie better than that," Usher laughed. "Well, your dreams are your business. Mine's in the kitchen, and I'd best be getting back before Gage starts to shouting and waving that big wooden spoon of his. By your leave, my prince."
She should never have talked about the wolf dreams, Bran thought, as Hodor carried him up the steps to his bedchamber. He fought against sleep as long as he could, but in the end
it took him as it always did. On this night, he dreamed of the weirwood. It was looking at him with its deep red eyes, calling to him with its twisted wooden mouth, and from its pale branches the three-eyed crow came flapping, pecking at his face, and crying his name in a voice as sharp as swords. The blast of horns woke him. Bran pushed himself onto his side, grateful for the reprieve. He heard horses and boisterous shouting. More guests have come, and half drunk by the sound of them. Grasping his bars, he pulled himself from the bed and over to the window seat. On their banner was a giant in shattered chains that told him that these were Umbermen, down from the Northlands beyond the last river. The next day, two of them came together to audience. The great John's uncles, blustery men, in the winter of their days, with beards as white as the bearskin cloaks they wore. A crow had once taken Mors for dead and pecked out his eye, so he wore a chunk of dragon glass in its stead. As old Nan told the tale, he'd grabbed the crow in his fist and bitten its head off. So they named him Crow Food. She would never tell Bran why his gaunt brother Hotha was called Horsbane. No sooner had they been seated than Mors asked for leave to wed Lady Hornwood.
"The great Juns, the young wolf's strong right hand, all know that to be true. Who better to protect the widow's lands than an Umber, and what Umber better than me?"
"Lady Danella is still grieving," Maester Lewin said.
"I have a cure for grief under my furs," Mors laughed. Sir Roderick thanked him courteously and promised to bring the matter before the lady and the king.
Hotha wanted ships. "There's wildlings stealing down from the north, more than I've ever seen before. They cross the Bay of Seals in little boats and wash up on our shores. The crows in Eastwatch are too few to stop them, and they go to ground quick as weasels. It's long ships we need, aye, and strong men to sail them. The great John took too many. Half our harvest has gone to seed for want of arms to swing the scythe."
Sir Roderick pulled at his whiskers. "You have forests of tall pine and old oak. Lord Manderley has shipwrights and sailors in plenty. Together you ought to be able to float enough longships to guard both your coasts."
"Manderley, ha!" Mors Umber snorted. "That great waddling sack of suet. His own people muck him, as Lord Lamprey, I've heard. The man can scarce walk. If you stuck a sword in his belly, 10,000 eels would wriggle out."
"He is fat," Sir Roderick admitted, "but he is not stupid. You will work with him, or the king will know the reason why." And to Bran's astonishment, the truculent Umbers agreed to do as he commanded, though not without grumbling. While they were sitting at audience, the Glover men arrived from Deepwood Mutt, and a large party of tall hearts from Torren Square. Galbert and Robert Glover had left Deepwood in the hands of Robert's wife, but it was their steward who came to Winterfell. "My lady begs that you excuse her absence. Her babes are still too young for such a journey, and she was loath to leave them." Bran soon realized it was the steward, not Lady Glover, who truly ruled at Deepwood Mott. The man allowed that he was at present setting aside only a tenth of his harvest. A hedge wizard had told him there would be a bountiful spirit summer before the cold set in, he claimed. Maester Lewin had a number of choice things to say about hedge wizards. Sir Roderick commanded the man to set aside a fifth, and questioned the steward closely about Lord Hornwood's bastard, the boy Laren Snow. In the north, all highborn bastards took the surname Snow. This lad was near 12, and the steward praised his wits and courage.
"Your notion about the bastard may have merit, Bran," Maester Lewin said after. "One day you will be a good lord for Winterfell, I think.
No, I won't. Bran knew he would never be a lord, no more than he could be a knight. Rob's to marry some Frey girl, you told me so yourself, and the Walders say the same. He'll have sons, and they'll be the lords of Winterfell after him, not me.
It may be so, Bran, Sir Roderick said, but I was wed 3 times, and my wives gave me daughters. Now only Beth remains to me. My brother Martin fathered 4 strong sons, yet only Jorry lived to be a man. When he was slain, Martin's line died with him. When we speak of the morrow, nothing is ever certain.
Leobold, a tall heart, had his turn the following day. He spoke of weather portents and the slack wits of small folk, and told how his nephew itched for battle.
Benfred has raised his own company of lancers, boys, none older than 19 years, but everyone thinks he's another young wolf. When I told them they were only young rabbits, they laughed at me. Now they call themselves the Wild Hares, and gallop about the country with rabbit skins tied to the ends of their lances, singing songs of chivalry.
Bran thought that sounded grand. He remembered Benfred Tallheart, a big, bluff, loud boy who had often visited Winterfell with his father, Sir Helman, and had been friendly with Rob and with Theon Greyjoy. But Sir Roderick was clearly displeased by what he heard.
If the king were in need of more men, he would send for them, he said. Instruct your nephew that he is to remain at Torrhen Square, as his lord father commanded.
I will, sir, said Leobold, and only then raised the matter of Lady Hornwood.
Poor thing, with no husband to defend her lands, no son to inherit. His own lady wife was a Hornwood, sister to the late Lord Hallis, doubtless they recalled.
An empty hall is a sad one. I had a thought to send my younger son to Lady Danella to foster as her own. Baron is near 10, a likely lad, and her own nephew. He would cheer her, I'm certain, and perhaps he would even take the name Hornwood.
If he were named heir, suggested Maester Lewin.
So the house might continue, finished Leobold.
Bran knew what to say.
Thank you for the notion, my lord, he blurted out before Sir Roderick could speak. We will bring the matter to my brother Rob, oh, and Lady Hornwood.
Leobold seemed surprised that he had spoken.
I'm grateful, my prince, he said.
But Bran could see pity in his pale blue eyes, mingled perhaps with a little gladness that the cripple was, after all, not his son. For a moment he hated the man.
Maester Lewin liked him better, though. Beren Tallheart may well be our best answer, he told them when Leobold had gone. By blood he is half Hornwood. If he takes his uncle's name, he will still be a boy, said Sir Roderick, and hard-pressed to hold his lands against the likes of Mors Umber, or this bastard of Roose Bolton's. We must think on this carefully. Rob should have our best counsel before he makes his decision. It may come down to practicalities, said Maester Lewin. Which lord he most needs to court? The Riverlands are part of his realm. He may wish to cement the alliance by wedding Lady Hornwood to one of the Lords of the Trident. A Blackwood, perhaps, or a Frey.
Lady Hornwood can have one of our Freys, said Bran. She can have both of them if she likes.
You are not kind, my prince, Sir Roderick chided gently.
Neither are the Walders. Scarling, Bran stared down at the table and said nothing. In the days that followed, ravens arrived from other lordly houses bearing regrets. The bastard of the Dreadfort would not be joining them. The Mormonts and Carstarks had all gone south with Rob. Lord Locke was too old to dare the journey. Lady Flint was heavy with child. There was sickness at Widow's Watch. Finally, all of the principal vassals of House Stark had been heard from, save for Harlan Reed, the Crannock man, who had not set foot outside his swamps for many a year, and the Serwins, whose castle lay half a day's ride from Winterfell. Lord Serwyn was a captive of the Lannisters, but his son, a lad of 14, arrived one bright, blustery morning at the head of 24 lancers. Bran was riding Dancer around the yard when they came through the gate. He trotted over to greet them. Clay Serwyn had always been a friend to Bran and his brothers. "Good morning, Bran," Clay called out cheerfully. "Or must I call you Prince Bran now?" "Only if you want." Clay laughed. "Why not? Everyone else is a king or prince these days. Did Stannis write Winterfell as well?" "Stannis? I don't know." "He's a king now, too," Clay confided. "He says Queen Cersei bedded her brother, so Joffrey is a bastard."
"Joffrey the ill-born," one of the Serwyn knights growled. "Small wonder he's faithless, with a kingslayer for a father."
"Aye," said another, "the guards ate incest. Look how they brought down the Targaryens."
For a moment Bran felt as though he could not breathe. A giant hand was crushing his chest. He felt as though he was falling, and clutched desperately at Dancer's reins. His terror must have shown on his face.
"Bran?" Clay Serwyn said. "Are you unwell? It's only another king.
Rob will beat him too."
He turned Dancer's head toward the stables, oblivious to the puzzled stares the Serwyns gave him. His blood was roaring in his ears, and had he not been strapped onto the saddle, he might well have fallen. That night, Bran prayed to his father's gods for dreamless sleep. If the gods heard, they mocked his hopes, for the nightmare they sent was worse than any wolf dream.
"Fly or die,"
cried the three-eyed crow as it pecked at him. He wept and pleaded, but the crow had no pity. It put out his left eye, and then his right. And when he was blind in the dark, it pecked at his brow, driving its terrible sharp beak deep into his skull. He screamed until he was certain his lungs must burst. The pain was an axe splitting his head apart. But when the crow wrenched out its beak, all slimy with bits of bone and brain, Bran could see again. What he saw made him gasp in fear. He was clinging to a tower miles high, and his fingers were slipping, nails scrabbling at the stone, his legs dragging him down, stupid, useless, dead legs.
"Help me," he cried.
A golden man appeared in the sky above him and pulled him up. "The things I do for love," he murmured softly, as he tossed him out, kicking into empty air.